So, hello. And so here we are on Soil Matters. Here's Marsha Roo.
Hello, everyone.
And Bear is also with us. Do you want to say a little bit about why we've come together today, and maybe then we can all introduce ourselves a little bit? Is that a good idea?
Right. I also wanted to maybe do a pronounce check.
Sounds great.
Right. So do you want to start?
Yeah. So I'm Tanya, and I go by the pronouns they, them.
Okay. I'm Marsha Roo, go also by they, them.
I'm Bear Silver, and I use he or they, either one.
Cool. Thank you a lot.
I would like to talk about that, actually, just for a quick second.
Sure.
I like they because in English especially, there's a singular they. It's a thing. It's like, or, you know, Shakespeare did it. It's hundreds of years old. It's a real thing. People tell you it's not grammatically correct, they're wrong. But also because I am two-spirit and they speaks directly to them. I use he because I know that a lot of linguistic traditions are super heavily gendered and it's really hard to do a neutral, gender-neutral thing, so he is also acceptable. That's how that works for me. So.
Cool, thank you so much. And actually, you already partly answered Tanya's question on why we wanted to have you here. I heard you sharing your story as two-spirit and indigenous North American, and I wanted to know more about your background, your culture, and of course, I learn myself about non-binary gender here in the Netherlands, and I understood this is something I identify with, but then here it comes up as something rather modern and almost being presented as, you know, some kind of Western invention, but actually this is something that has been existing for ages in many cultures across the globe. So I'm really fascinated, and I want to hear from you about this and your experience and your culture.
My culture. So I'm originally from California, but the tribes that I am from are not based in California. My mother is Cherokee and Blackfoot, and my father is Cherokee and Irish. That's how that goes. So I did grow up at times on a reservation, but it was on a Paiute reservation, which is a Western tribe that is not my tribe. So that was already an issue. I'm not the right Indian. I'm not completely Indian, and I'm not even the right Indian. So that was weird growing up. I'm very white passing. We can't tell that on the radio, but I'm very white passing. And that doesn't do me any favors on a reservation, for sure.
Can you say what is a reservation?
Europeans came to North America and thought that nobody was living there. That's the general narrative.
Yeah, great one.
You're probably familiar with it. With lots of negotiating, there ended up being little bits of land that were set aside, usually land that white people didn't want. So it was usually not good farmland. Very often out in the desert, or some place, not good farmland, maybe not a lot of water. And even today, the highest rates of poverty in North America exist on reservations. So that's a thing.
But then it's kind of like a place to put all these other people that supposedly didn't really live there in the first place, or?
Very often people are relocated. So taken away from your homeland and then moved somewhere else, you know, like there's still a very small area in Cherokee, North Carolina, that's part of the traditional homeland. But if you look at a map of North America, how much was traditional Cherokee land versus how much is, and you know, look at the different times and how much it, you know, by how much does it shrink? And so now there's also a Cherokee reservation. There are the Western Cherokees, which are the ones in Oklahoma, and then there are even a group of Cherokees based in California. We get around. It's not unusual. I mean, part of the reason that Europeans were able to make it in North America was because there were natives that had gone to Europe and learned the languages and come back. So there were You know, when the pilgrims came to Plymouth Rock, there was already a native there who had been to England and spoke English, so he could communicate with these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and the
yeah.
same thing happened down in Florida with the Seminoles and the Spanish.
And did these people become like... well, I'm going to say, like, I know from in Australia that then, like, some of the few people in these very early times, from some of the few Indigenous peoples that then, yes, seem to, like, have some more connection with the white Europeans, then became sort of like these show ponies. And was that, can you relate to that or not so much?
I think that happened a lot later, you know, when there were a lot more Europeans and they were more settled and they were looking for entertainment and, you know, people came west from New York, the big city, and oh, we get to see real life wild Indians in the sideshow. There's that kind of thing. Not exactly human zoo, but kind of human zoo. Yeah, but that didn't happen until the late 1800s and early 19s. Early on, that wasn't the case.
Wow, thank you a lot for sharing. I feel like already I learned a lot from this few minutes of a conversation of something I really don't know.
Yeah, thank you.
And yeah, I'm wondering, would you actually like to share how was it growing up in the reservation? Or we can also skip this.
Yeah, or maybe as a queer person.
Oh man. I grew up in a very my grandfather, his oldest siblings, two oldest siblings were taken away to boarding schools. I think they have a similar thing in Australia. You know, take you away from your family and teach you how to be white, basically cut your hair and, you know, speak the language, you know, learn your traditions and then send you back to your family. So my great-grandmother took the remaining kids and ran away to a different part of the state and told them to tell the neighbors if anybody asks we're white and your dad died in the mine because their dad wasn't around, he was an alcoholic. And so I grew up with people that were doing their best to be white. My mother, that was my grandfather that this happened to. He wasn't even born actually when his mother moved with the rest of the kids. But my mother started digging into the traditions. I guess when I was a teenager, I don't remember exactly when. So, like, we're slowly bringing it back. And for a while, I went back to the States when my dad had a stroke, and I happened to be living was, like, really in the heart of the traditional Cherokee homeland. So I was able to do a lot of research, like, to travel to places and, okay, this is where this treaty was signed. This is where the first newspaper that was printed in Cherokee, in the Cherokee language, was printed here. This is where... You know, this is where all these things happen. I walked on a portion of the Trail of Tears. This is where they rounded up four different tribes and, you know, put them in internment camps before they shipped them off to what is now Oklahoma. All around Chattanooga, Tennessee, there were, like, all along the river there were internment camps. People, half the tribe died of malaria before they even started walking. Yellow fever, malaria, they're related. So, mosquito-borne illnesses. There's a lot of detail. There's a lot of history, and you know, this is just one tribe. I don't know anything about the Blackfoot side of my family. Like I don't have any contact with that side of the family. So I don't really know those traditions. The people that raised me, even though we weren't raised in the Cherokee homeland, the people that raised me were Cherokee. So those are the traditions and the stories that I know.
Right. And could you share with us a bit more about two spirits within Cherokee tradition?
There's an issue with that because the Cherokee were one of the first tribes that had European contact, and so they were doing their best to fit in with all this European bullshit, which means that if you ask, there is no third gender. But I mean, obviously there is. But according to what we know, traditionally there isn't. That's not true. I mean, traditionally they also, like if you look at the illustrations, you'll see that the traditional Cherokee male headdress is a sort of turban. And this comes from, I mentioned that there were natives that had gone to India, to England. There was a Cherokee delegate, there were 13 chiefs that had gone to England and visited the Queen, and everybody was freaked out about their tattoos and their wild hair, and they're half naked, and we cannot show this to the Queen. So there had recently been a Turkish delegation, and they'd left a bunch of clothing, there, and so it was somewhere in a closet. So in order to not offend the Queen's delicate sensibilities, they just got all these Turkish clothes out of the closet and dressed these Cherokee, this Cherokee delegation in these Turkish clothes. So they were wearing a mix of Turkish clothes and Cherokee clothing. And the turbans were nice. The turbans were a great idea. They would work in the forest. So, we're taking our European fashion home. This is in the 1700s.
So then it came back to Cherokee and into the group.
Yeah, but it's not Cherokee. It's not traditional. I have no idea what's traditional before that. And I stopped wearing that turban when I realized where it came from. I used to wear it.
See, right. What does it look like? Can you describe it?
I mean, I'm looking around for a cloth. You just take a cloth and wrap it around your head.
I'm looking around for a turban right now.
When you got around your waist, I've also done it with t-shirts. I mean,
here we go.
Yeah, you just here.
It's happening. A Turkish Cherokee turban.
Right. But most people don't realize that. And I've definitely gotten weird looks from people in the past when my white passing self has worn some kind of turban. But, I did it because, like I said, I thought that that's what the traditional dress was. And when I did more research, I found this story and was like, oh, okay, I can stop wearing that. This is actually not long enough, but just...
Almost.
Just something, you just twist it up and... This is actually pretty thick, but I would use a longer cloth. But yeah, something like this. You should have one too. And the forests in Georgia and the Carolinas they're pine and deciduous. They're not like jungly tropical forests or anything.
Wow, your look is really fascinating. Now I have never seen you wearing something like this.
I wish I took a photo. The moment passed.
It's really warm shirt.
Yeah, it's woolen. All right, so if anyone gets cold today, we've got backup. Yeah. Okay, but then you said so sometimes, I guess it's advantageous to be white passing, and other times, not advantageous.
I mean, it makes my life in Europe easy, for sure. It also means that it erases part of my identity. So, people are always shocked, some people are just start to get weird about it and bring it up at every conversation, and if you're black, I'm not going to bring up that you're black at every conversation. Why are we doing this? So
it's pretty uncomfortable, and maybe even more uncomfortable is one uncomfortable situation is when people say this line of oh, but don't worry, you can't tell, or something.
Yeah. Well, I can very often tell that people can't tell just by the way that they're the things that they're saying, because they think I'll be okay with it.
Mm. Yeah. And can I ask about just sort of the living situation in these reservations? Are people living in this same in brick houses or more? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Houses, trailers. I mean, there are certainly traditional, there are longhouses. People are building longhouses, especially the Navajo and the Zuni, in this area in the Southwest. They still tend to do a lot of traditional buildings. I mean, people are also living in regular houses, but. It's a funny thing, the way that the perception that Europeans seem to have of non-Europeans, or non European descended. You know, Australians are European at some point. You know, because they like, I have friends from Africa, and they're like, yeah, we live in houses. My mom has a nice apartment. We don't live in mud huts. You know, there's this weird, I don't want to call it fetishizing it's just a weird perception that Europeans seem to have about non-European people, and I don't quite understand it.
Yeah, well, I guess I was asking because in Australia, a lot of the like high population indigenous communities outside of city areas, unfortunately, are living in what I would say is something like tent cities or slums.
Really?
Yeah, like pretty, yeah, some in some places. So that's sort of what I actually was referring.
Are they still nomadic? Are they still doing nomadic practices?
No. Not those groups. They're sort of like living on the outskirts of the cities, okay. Some of the cities. A bit in between. Maybe they do go out or to another area for a while and come back. Okay. So it's a bit temporary. But definitely some sort of modified or half-half or...
Yeah. I feel like you can see that more in cities. And I have actually seen in Vancouver, in Canada... there's also Vancouver, Washington State. But in Vancouver, Canada, I've definitely seen populations of indigenous First Nations. I love that term, actually. But it's almost always used by Canadians.
The Australian indigenous people also say First Nations. Or the original caretakers also, which I think is kind of similar.
I really like that term. So you do see First Nations living in cities in this kind of, you know, tent city-ish. But that won't be exclusively natives in that community either, so...
I actually really like the term First Nations, and it is something very different from, you know, the term First World, Second World, Third World.
Mm.
And it goes into a totally different direction, and it makes me feel really right about using it.
Yeah, that's an interesting parallel, because the First World is like sort of supposedly the better one, and then First Nations then also sounds like that's the better one, so that's a really nice line to draw.
I like First Nations just because we were the first ones here, and then you brought your weird government, your weird ways of doing things.
I actually wanted also to ask you, you mentioned that in your family you had somebody who's Cherokee Irish, right? What would this mean? If I heard it correctly.
You did. It means that their lineages come from these places.
Right. I guess it's a mix of... Right. And I also wanted to ask you, since when do you identify as the spirit?
Oh, I don't know. Since my early 20s, probably. I mean, I was 21 when the term was invented, so I'm sure as soon as I heard it, I was like, okay, there it is. Yeah.
You felt immediately connected to it. Felt.
I mean, I was a part of the community that was creating it. Yeah.
You know what's interesting? I just want to share one story because I was born in Soviet Union, and just before it collapsed, my dad and mom ended up in United States, which was still difficult because it was a closed country. But my dad could get some internship there in US, and just in July, 1991, so it is before August, the first like military coup was in August, they were in US, and they ended up being in Gay Pride, and they took pictures with these banners of two spirits. So I'm wondering, this was then the first year when the term appeared, and this is so special that my parents were there and they took pictures, and I was still a kid, so I saw it just later and I made these connections, because they're still in the album. They still have it in the family home.
Yeah, so that's very cool. But I guess, maybe to come touch on, I don't know. Okay, well, maybe first say, like, why did you adopt it so fast? And you were just like, yes.
I mean, I was already, okay, so I was in San Francisco at the time. I had been in San Francisco since 1989, and you have to remember that at that time HIV was like really just wiping people out, hundreds of like you could if you lived in an apartment building, like if you in certain neighborhoods, you could wake up, you know, you go home on Friday and then you wake up Monday morning and like everybody in your apartment is dead because you live with a bunch of gay boys and they're all dead now. So this is like the backdrop in San Francisco. I was taking care of, and you know, I had identified as a lesbian, and from, oh, I don't know, from the time I was probably 18, like I actually took it on as a title, let's say. So when I was like 21.
We can also talk about that title, it's also a funny one, but maybe another day. Yeah.
2021, 2022, I was taking care of all these gay men that were dying. And there weren't a lot of people that were doing it, and there was still like this is not the first plague that I've lived through. So I was taking care of all these gay men, and I also happened to be working for, like, you know, you try to keep all your gay bubble around you, right? So I was working for this, she identified as a gay woman, not a lesbian, I don't know why. But she and some of her friend, you know, all of her gay and lesbian friends, like, to me, there's a difference between gay and lesbian and queer. And I use the term queer because these people all around me, all these gays and lesbians, were just letting people die, while those of us that were taking care of them, we were all a bunch of filthy queers. They were filthy queers. We were filthy queers for taking care of them. So,
like, you were filthy queers for not being either a lesbian or gay, and therefore you were this sort of other of the filthy queer?
It wasn't even about that. It was just they were drawing a line between men who got sick and men who didn't. And, I mean, lesbians weren't really getting HIV at that point. It rarely happened. They were barely making the connection between IV drug use and HIV. And so there was this weird divide that happened in the LGBT community. And those of us that were sick or taking care of sick people were a bunch of filthy queers. And all these gays and lesbians didn't want anything to do with us. So for me, it just means that I have enough compassion to not let people die alone. And, you know, if you want to call me a filthy queer because of that, that's fine. So for me, it was a political thing way before it was about who I slept with. And it still is to this day. It really is. So I don't even remember what the question was. How did we get on this topic?
I'm not sure, but I also really agree that it's a combination of sort of your sexuality and your politics as to whether you say queer or lesbian or gay. So I think it's really fantastic, the term queer, and I really embrace it. And particularly because, well, partly because of the division and partly because then I guess I would feel like I fall into the group of lesbian, and then I have a lot of problems being in that community, so...
There used to be, at this time, there was a joke, what's the difference between a dyke and a lesbian? So I wasn't even identifying as a lesbian, but as a dyke, right? But then all the dykes were, I was a filthy queer, okay, fine. So what's the difference between a dyke and a lesbian?
What?
About $40,000 a year.
What? I don't
care. It's a class issue, because dykes are working class. Yeah, and lesbians are, you know, business people.
Yep. Right.
Wow, I never thought about that. Somehow, I myself more sympathize with term dyke than a lesbian.
Especially with that new definition.
It was before like this. I had always struggled with term lesbian, yeah. And I never identified in this way. And actually for me, it was really... like opening to like hear this term queer and non-binary, because I really never could fit into the system, like to being called gay or lesbian. It never felt right for me, and especially where I come from, it also has a particular connotation, because these are like Western terms, and this is some kind of something coming from West, and this is like also some kind of colonizing, you know. And there also there can be queer people who are just not very pro-Western and they don't want to identify with this. But I mean, of course, queer is also the inter-Western word, but still it has a different type of a connotation, for me at least.
Definitely. But we were talking about why you identified as two-spirit, and then you were saying that you didn't identify as a lesbian, or you used to, and then you identified as queer, and then also two-spirit.
Because two-spirit speaks to my being native.
So it kind of like spoke to your feeling of like lineage and feeling of lineage and heritage or family.
I grew up in a white world, whatever, white society, but there was always this undertone of there was always these other undertones, and like queer is all encompassing, but again, it doesn't, you know, like there's queer, there's black queer, there's queer of color, you know, there's all these things, and Two-Spirit like says a very specific thing. It's part of who I am, and it brings that, it says that without having to go into all this other blah 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 blah, you know.
Will you tell the listeners at home what is Two-Spirit?
The way that it was explained to me was if there are two people who have a life where they love each other so much that they can't bear to be apart, and it's not about lovers, you know, it's not just about lovers. It can be siblings, it can be a parent and child, it can be lovers, it doesn't have to be. But just two people that love each other so much that they can't bear to be apart, they come together in another spirit in the next life. And you see it in nature, you see it in trees. If we were in the city, I mean, even if we just go across the street to Donald Park, you know, you'll see it, and you'll see the trees, you know, there's one root coming out of the ground, but then suddenly you've really got two big trunks, you know. You see it in nature, you see it in animals. There's a whole list of like 1,000 different animals that partner with whoever they partner with. And according to the elder that told me, explained to me what Two-Spirit is about. Also, when people are pregnant, they're Two-Spirit for a while because there's another spirit inside them. So even during that time, if you're carrying a child, you know, you're at least temporarily Two-Spirit. And apparently there is so much work to do to bring the world back into balance that some of us need to be Two-Spirit because we need that kind of strength.
This sounds beautiful.
I mean,
but it's also not easy.
It's yeah. But that's how it was explained to me. So.
Yeah, it makes me think when I was explaining non-binary gender pronouns to some people in Russia, and one person said, yeah, of course, this makes sense. If you use these multiple pronouns, like they, them, you also acknowledge that you are more than one. And I guess this also was linked to the Two-Spirit concept in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, different tribes have different traditions, and some tribes still very much honor this tradition. And some very much don't. And like religion, it's funny, like religion is very often to blame for making everything very binary, but like the whole Trinity thing, like there's not, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why everything has to be binary if you can get three different gods to choose from, God, Father, Son, and Ghost, right?
Three different, but all the same.
Right. Right, so yeah, different genders, yeah, can be three, can be five. Different names for each of them. Very often in literature, yeah, hopefully you don't see it in newer, you shouldn't see it in newer literature. You see this term, berdash, which is corrupted French, and it's actually considered derogatory. Nobody really uses this term anymore. So if you're reading somebody's something or other about it, and it's, you know, something recent, and they're still using this terminology, I would encourage you to question anything else you read by this person. So
right, and I also remember you shared that you've been on some Two-Spirit gatherings.
No.
Oh, maybe I misremembered. Okay. This was my imagination.
Actually, that's technically not true. I did with a group that was before the term Two-Spirit. There was a group of LGBT natives that occupied Alcatraz for, I think, gosh, what was it? I don't remember now, for the holiday. But we occupied Alcatraz for about 3 days because like very many reservations, there's no water there. It's shitty land. You can't grow anything. It's windswept. It's just, it literally is a big rock. So, just to make a big statement. So, yeah, but that was before the term Two-Spirit was a thing. So, what was the question?
But you all identified as like some kind of, gender.
Yeah, non-hetero. Yeah, for sure.
Right. Oh, I guess maybe the story was about the moon camp that I remember.
I have been to a number of traditional gatherings in Northern California. One of the Northern California tribes that's actually not recognized by the government, but still manages to hold on to a little bit of their land, has to get permission from the Forest Service to have ceremonies, traditional ceremonies on their own traditional land. So they're not really holding on to it technically, but they've hosted these ceremonies. And one year when I went, and people came from all over the western U.S. to come to this. So it wasn't just Californians that came, but like from many different states. And over the course of like 3 days before the ceremony, you know, weekend finally officially opened, people were showing up. You know, I showed up in the middle of the night and with my friends and other people. But like, it turned out that there were loads and loads of Two-Spirits that came from all over the place. They'd never been to this particular gathering before. And we all ended up in the same, just camping near each other. It just happened that way. Which is when I heard the story that I just told you a little while ago. It was that weekend. And Barbara, Auntie Barbara that told me that story, she was from Wyoming. So people really came from all over for this. And that wasn't meant to be, it wasn't the Two-Spirit gathering per se, but there were a lot of Two-Spirits there. And there were a lot of traditionalists, which traditionalists in the U.S. really are very Christianized. But these traditionalists were really freaked out by all these, you know, and most of us, of course, were also not just Two-Spirit, but also like two ethnicities. So very few of us were pure Indians. So did I roll my eyes hard?
Yeah, can we like have a radio, like we need a radio sound effect for rolling the eyes? But what are traditionalists? Do you mean traditionalists in terms of indigenous peoples or white peoples?
Indigenous people. Yeah, Christianized indigenous people. It's probably the best way to describe it. And it's, you know, and they like, you know, they still go to powwows, they still do all the fry bread, do the crafts and do the native government and very gendered everything, and if you're there, like you just can't be gay. You just can't. You know, never mind queer. But this is another. Then you're gonna be another dirty queer. So, like, I wouldn't exactly say that I grew up with traditionalists. Although when I was, I think, I don't know, 9 or 10, I think my mom found Jesus. So, I was dealing with all that homophobia. So I wasn't even. You know, I wasn't even trying to. I wasn't even trying to be. I was trying really hard to be straight, but it was interesting, you know, there were a lot of people around me that even when I didn't want to see it, they saw it, so.
Was that helpful?
For me?
Yeah.
No, it hurt, because I was trying so hard.
Oh,
and it felt dangerous. It felt dangerous, really.
And so, but then, why are these traditionalists rejecting of gay and queer?
Because they're Christianized.
Okay, so if the Christianized, if they had been traditionalists without the Christian coming in there and making them all Christian, would then in this context, if you can kind of imagine what I'm trying to ask,
well, then there would still be actively, openly, you know, there would be however many genders the Cherokee had before all this European contact. Like the Diné, the Navajo still have, I think, 5 different, and they have words and names, like they honor them. It's part of the culture because they weren't, and it's not, they're not Christianized, but they didn't take on this whole, it has to be binary male or female and that's it.
Yeah.
I don't know what the differences are. I would like to understand that myself.
All right. Well, there's a call. anyone's listening.
I'm just wondering, because I've been to a few places in the world and I see actually non-binary gender present in traditional cultures across the globe in different continents. But when I go back to my own home, and I have also roots in the north of Russia, and there are also local traditions there, like there are some folks, they're called Pomor, and there is also a discussion if it's a folk or ethnical group or what is it. But I mean, there are quite some traditional communities living in like simple traditional houses. There is no things like running water, or you would heat the house with the wood. So, and it's also often in faraway places. And I got engaged also with these traditional communities. It's often also about communication with ancestors and their very interesting practices. And I was in such a community this winter, and I decided to give a workshop on non-binary gender. And people were just like, no, that's not a part of our culture. So I'm wondering, what do you think? Is it, would it be like a part of every, let's say, traditional culture, or there are some cultures that were traditionally binary, or is it something that people have just erased or forgotten? Do you have an opinion or kind of sense of it?
I have an opinion.
Let's go for it.
I mean, I think any culture, every culture, like the binary is a part of everything. You know, like there are men, there are women, like they're everywhere. I honestly feel like the whole organized religion and or like I know that also the Soviet government did a lot to get rid of any kind of organized religion, so like these extremes of religion I feel like have a lot to do with it at some point. And I don't believe it when people say it's not a part of our culture. If it's not a part of our culture, then I want to know why, and nobody ever seems to be able to tell why.
I guess what I mean, if you understand me correctly, that's so, okay, culture is very binary. So, you know, in these places, it's not just binary gender, man and woman, but woman is really with long hair and with long skirt. And man is really, you know, with a hammer in the hand and with long beard. So it is like super binary. And something in between seems to be, like people would say, that's not historically a part of us, but that's the question then what I'm asking. Is it like this?
Is it
really like this? Is it something that has never been there, or is it something that has been forgotten?
I believe it's something that's been forgotten. I think it's been there. I think it's a part of every culture everywhere at some point. I think it's always been there.
Right, and then it's just getting forgotten because of some political issues, religious things, or I don't... What is the reason for it, actually?
People are inherently lazy, and if it's not easy to classify, then you're either going to demonize it or just get rid of it. And demonizing it is a way of getting rid of it, but if people are like, it's not easy to classify for people, they don't want to deal with it.
Right. Because I'm also talking about like very particular part of Russia, because in Russia there are also many different folks living, and I know that some folks living to the more to the east, there would be also, I guess, more. I don't know if it's right to say gender roles, but there would be, for example, something like a role of man, a role of woman, and then a role of a shaman, and this would be another kind of gender role in the culture. That's how I learned about it.
I think I could see the point that even in Christianity, that the priest is a little bit a different gender, because they do not have the same gender roles as the men, like as the other men in society. They're supposedly they don't have sex. Supposedly, like they don't have children, they don't get married, they don't do part of the same work. They don't have this, like, in that way, it's not the same gender role.
I think Orthodox priests have wives and kids, don't they?
Yeah, in that context, then they do. And then it's a bit more like they have the same gender role, but then another role, which is, like, maybe a little bit more, like, not the same, but sort of going to work or another occupation, also special role they have. But I like the idea of...
The rules that men tend to have in societies are... They tend to be power roles, and if, like, you know, you have to maintain that somehow, and you maintain that by having gender roles, and people that don't subscribe to those are just fucking up the whole system. And if they do it long enough, then, you know, we're or hard enough or whatever, then we don't want them. It's ways of maintaining power. It's a way of maintaining hierarchical power as opposed to, let's say, horizontal power.
What I'm wondering about, I guess where I was going with this story, is that it seems that often this non-binary gender in traditional cultures also has to do something with some kind of, I guess, spiritual mission, if I can put it this way. Am I right about it? What is your, do you have a sense? What's your opinion about it?
My opinion about that is that, again, people are lazy, and spirituality is hard work, and it's sometimes frightening work. And if you have a shaman, you don't have to do that yourself. You can put all that shit off on your shaman. Does that make sense?
I don't know. Yes, but I want to know more somehow.
I mean, that doesn't mean I'm right, but I feel like there's a certain like fetishizing of trans people in particular. You know, like there are certain cultures, like there's this idea that there are certain cultures where your third gender is some shaman person, and so or you can't be a shaman unless you're some kind of third. Like there's always some kind of spirituality and gender conflation almost. Which, in my mind, absolves the general population of doing any kind of deep spiritual work. If we want to know about deep spiritual work, we go talk to our shaman. We don't do the deep spiritual work ourselves. We expect somebody else to do it. And to be sure, the way that the world functions means that other people have to do this deep spiritual work to get through the fucking world. But again, I think it goes back to people being lazy and afraid.
So you're saying that like there could have been or there could be other trans people in these situations, but the only trans people that we know about, like now in the present, looking back at history, are the ones that were shamans or in this spiritual position, either because the other people, were too scared or ashamed to like come out in a way or be public about it, or
because laziness is built into cultures.
Yeah,
I mean, cultures are made up of humans, and humans are inherently lazy. We want to be comfortable, and I'm not criticizing this. I want to be comfortable too. You know, like I want to have a wood stove. I want to be comfortable in the sense, but like I want to live a particular way. You know, and living in the city is not that particular way. I've just been living up the IAM for a month, and like this is way closer to the way that I want to live my life. You know, I have to find my wood. I have to go out and pick mushrooms to eat. I mean, I have to eat out of the garden, but I chose to. It's a very different way of living, and cultures, like spirituality is hard work. Spirituality is hard work, and like cultures are made up of people, and people don't want to work too hard. And that includes whether it's digging holes or digging through your own psychic bullshit, your own personal history, your own demons, whatever it may be. And like cultures all over the world have a history of some form of sacrificial lamb. You know, we put all our sins on this one and then we burn it. We put all of our spiritual stuff on the shaman and let them deal with it instead of taking it on ourselves. Why is the shaman never some straight dude with three kids? Why not? I mean,
well, because
there could be, because the straight dude with three kids is putting all of his spiritual work off on somebody else, which is why straight dudes are the way that they are, which is why a lot of people are the way that they are. It's not just straight dudes, but a lot of people need to do a lot of spiritual work, and myself included. I mean, everybody does, I think. That's why we're here. We get these weird vehicles in this, to navigate this world, to do this work. And for some of us, it's easier to, we just go to the priest and we eat a little cookie and just sip a little juice and, rattle the beads. I don't know what Catholics do. We don't have to deal with God ourselves. We go to the priest. We don't have to deal with any of the weird spiritual shit. We just go to our shaman. And if we don't have a priest or we don't have a shaman, either we are dealing with our own spiritual stuff in our own way, or we're not. This is what I see anyway.
And then do you think if you are like outside of the binary gender, you're a bit more forced to deal with your spiritual shit?
Yeah.
Then you're a bit in the context of not having the priest or the... Yeah.
Makes sense. Yeah, I understand now.
In the studio today is Marsha Rue and Bear. Thank you both so much for coming in. And I guess, yeah, earlier we spoke a lot about this term two-spirit, and I was really interested to hear that you took it on so quickly and warmly. And I think then that's like really fantastic, because I guess that's the whole point of then having a term that people feel then they have it to identify with. And but I guess I wondered if people felt like it was problematic because it creates this sort of, well, I wonder if it creates an illusion that there is this one two-spirit practice, that there is this one two-spirit practice that's in all of the different groups, all of the different tribes, because indeed there is no two-spirit, but it's like that many groups had another gender or a non-binary, well, maybe not a non-binary gender, but like, a non-binary gender, another gender or third or fourth or fifth gender. And this is all encompassed in two-spirit, but no group ever called themselves as having a two-spirit gender till then. And in that way, it's a, yeah.
Do you do this? It's a term that was used in order to kind of communicate with the outside world. To communicate a specific thing to the outside world. And like, I think even other North Americans, like European based, how do we call it, white North Americans, let's say, like non-native North Americans, tend to just like not realize that there are almost 600 different tribes that are just recognized by the U.S. government, and then there are, I don't know, 300 or 400 tribes that are not. And these are different. They have different languages and different cultures, and nobody realizes this. Nobody knows this. So they're going to lump all the tribes together under one umbrella. I think there's not that big a deal in saying, you know, like lumping all of the non-hetero natives under a non-hetero umbrella. I personally think there's no problem with it. I think if anything, non-natives need to become a little more educated, you know, like learn that there are so many different tribes. You know, you can't say that Europe is one big culture, and you shouldn't say the same thing about indigenous Americans. Oh my God. I don't want to say that. I like to use the term Turtle Islander, because where I'm from is Turtle Island. I don't know what the name is for South America, but North America is Turtle Island. So I'm a Turtle Islander.
Oh, right. Rock on.
I learned something new again from you.
Yeah. I really like that one, Turtle Island.
Me too. So yeah, no, I was curious because I also heard something like this about the two spirits, and I was curious also how the term was invented. Maybe you can share with us a bit more about it.
I think the most common idea about a third gender is, you know, there's men, there's women, and then there's a third gender, which is men and women together, so two spirit, right? I think this is where it comes from. I don't know all the details. I think it was... I think a lot of it had to do with the delegation that went to there was an international indigenous conference in Toronto that year in 1991, and this was a way to so people from Africa, people from Australia, just indigenous people, and this was a way to communicate who Turtle Islanders are, like the non Turtle Islanders. I don't know how they came up with it specifically.
All right.
Yeah, and I was going to say that I think from how I see it, it has done, like maybe it has created, added to this illusion of that there is this one large group of indigenous North Americans. It's definitely served its purpose in educating people that that third and fourth and fifth gender was a thing and a long-standing practice and a long-standing part of the culture. And even if it does, I guess all roads are a bit windy, and I guess it's a step forward, even though it might create some confusion. But like, for the people that are interested, they'll just keep stepping forward.
I mean, the worst case scenario is that somebody hears it and doesn't know what it means. Then you have a conversation. Then you have a chance to educate somebody. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, and Masha, you said you've heard people call it problematic.
I guess what I mean by it, it's not. I think it could have been if I would, as an outsider, would kind of put this term out, because, you know, I don't know your background, I don't know your culture. Maybe in your culture there would be some other terms. And by, like, say, putting this two-spirit, it would be, like, from my perspective, I think very... I don't think it would be appropriate, but when I know that you identify in this way, it's not problematic. I think it would be problematic for me to label everybody, you know, as a two-spirit.
Absolutely. Two-spirit it's not even an indigenous term. It's a Turtle Islander term. You're not a Turtle Islander, so you shouldn't be using it.
Yeah, I guess, of course, not for myself, but I mean from First Nations, because possibly there are people who would say, okay, but in my culture or in my background, this would be called this and this.
And if they know that, that's fucking fantastic. But very often we don't know that.
Right,
like,
right.
You know, I was raised mostly by Cherokee people. And there's been extensive research into third gender, fourth gender, you know, non-hetero, normative gender. There's been extensive research into how much this is, you know, which tribes have done what and who comes from where. And, you know, the Cherokee are very, like, we had the first printed word among Turtle Islanders, and there's no record of any... There's no record of a third gender report, and it's, you can't convince me that there's not somewhere back and far enough back, you know. Like, also, what's considered traditional Cherokee clothing is not. We were talking about this before,
right?
You know, so part of the problem with that is that European contact started so early that, like, all these measures were taken to you know, try and blend in. Like, somehow we saw what was going to happen, so we're going to do our best to kind of survive this coming thing. And if that means, you know, assimilating, and, oh, we're just like you don't need to destroy us, we're just like you. Oh, yeah. You came from churches and heteronormativity, oh, we're just like you, we do that too, and we'll erase all that. So yeah, I don't, if I had a traditional Cherokee term, I'd use it. I mean, I've picked up little few words of Cherokee here and there, and I use them when I can. I try to be really conscious of my language, and if I had a term, I would use it, but I don't.
Right, I understand.
So that's another, I think that's another good thing about Two-Spirit, because there's loads of Turtle Island culture that's been wiped out, and like, things are very patchwork. Even now, you know, like I mentioned that I've gone to traditional ceremony, they're very patchwork. They're very patchwork. A lot of songs have been lost, dances have been lost. I mean, a lot has been lost. So to have something like that term, for me, to have something like that term, Two-Spirit, to hold on to, like I said, if I had a more specific word to use, I would. And it wouldn't matter to me if nobody knew what it was about, because we can talk about that. And, you know, I don't, so I use Two-Spirit, and it works. It speaks directly to it. You know, like you mentioned that you didn't really have language for non-binary. There's no language for it where you're from. But then as soon as you got that language, you knew.
Right. I understand. Yeah, it makes sense. So I guess it's not that I'd say it's problematic, but I guess I would be careful with using it myself before knowing how people identify. I guess that's what I wanted to formulate. So yeah, thank you so much for explaining this. I feel like, again, I learned a lot. And I wanted to ask you also, because for quite a while you already live in Amsterdam. And how is your life here? You are doing quite cool stuff. You are like collecting herbs and mushrooms. And I saw you posting some pictures with it. And I'm really fascinated by actually your activities here on this land.
I started out with my in North America with the sister of my grandfather, going on walks with her out in in the forest, and she'd teach me this plant just for this and that plant just for that, and I'm very familiar with the vegetation in North America, and it's not just a part of my heritage, it's a part of everybody's heritage. It's just that people forget, you know, like people all over the world have done this forever. The thing that I miss the most about North America is the nature. Like in Europe, there's just been for hundreds of years, there's been an ongoing war against nature. You know, when you fly into the Netherlands, it looks like you're looking down on a computer chip. And I mean, at least when you fly into someplace like Poland, you know, there are farms, but like they kind of go with the flow of the landscape instead of just, you know, dig it out and bending it to our will. So a big part of me trying to keep sane in Amsterdam is connecting as much as possible with what little bit of nature there is here. I'm looking just this little plant that's peeking at the window right here, like this one. I only know a Dutch name for it. I don't know any Latin name for it, but this one here, like you can use the sap from this one to put it on warts and get rid of them. This one I think is probably an ornamental, but for a second I thought it was like this one of these wild brassicas that's like related to broccoli. So this is a tradition that I come from this tradition of using plants to take care of what's wrong with you. I mean, also like in the U.S. anyway, medical care does not come readily, so you gotta take care of yourself one way or another. So I've done my best to try and find what's natural here, even if that means just like clearing the park and laying in the middle of the field and looking up and seeing only stars and trees and an occasional plane for a minute. You know, like sometimes that's as close as I can get to nature here, or has felt as close as I can get. So last year when everything closed down thanks to COVID coming to town, then I lost all my work, suddenly I had a lot more time, and I'm not gonna just, I ended up in my studio, actually, that's where I isolated, was in my studio, so it's really, really nice to get out, but I would just go out foraging all the time, go out to Amsterdam, I'm both speaking both, I mean, it's, even in the Vondelpark, like, there's a magic log in Vondelpark that I've gotten, you know, two or three different kinds of mushrooms from all through last year and part of this year, and like edible mushrooms. Oosterpark, I think, is an exception. Like, Oosterpark is so manicured that you can't even find stinging nettle in there, which I find really weird.
I've never heard of such a place.
I've never either. It's really bizarre to me. I've never even found
a blessing and a curse.
Stinging nettle is awesome. Like, you can eat it. Use it like you would spinach, and it's super good for you. But I've also been using it. I've been having pain in my wrists.
How do you apply it? Because I've been told this before that you can. You can use stinging nettle for arthritis. What do you do? What's the remedy?
I stick my hands in there, and I just.
Okay. Just straight on there.
Yep, and it burns like hell for a few minutes, and I curse and yell and rah, 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 but then after like 5 minutes, it's fine.
I guess it just gets the circulation going.
I mean, it's not like there's no circulation. I don't know. I don't understand the mechanism. I don't. I mean, it's not like there's a problem. I don't have problems with circulation in my hands. I never have, but I have broken both of these thumbs and this wrist. So like, sometimes, and I'm 50, so sometimes they start to ache and.
You're 50?
I'm 50. Oh, you look younger.
I hear that a lot. I just call it nettle therapy, and like I just did it a couple days ago actually because I was having some pain in this thumb, so I went out there and shook hands with a few nettle plants and. I don't understand the mechanism. Like a lot of the things that when I find out when I learn I don't know much like. I went crazy last year, like this is the other thing, like, even though my my auntie taught me loads and loads of plants, like, my whole family was very mycophobic. Like, I have a really early memory of being, like, 3 or 4 years old and going out camping with my dad, and I still remember the mushroom. It was, I don't know what it was, but I remember how it looked, and I remember I grabbed it, and I, oh, no, that's a toadstool, put that down, my dad, you know, put that down, wash your hands. Like, nobody in my family knew anything about mushrooms, so I don't know what happened, but I just started learning a little more, and, like, mushrooms, the mycotrap is fucking amazing. There's so much going on. Do you know oyster mushrooms are carnivorous?
What do they eat?
Nematodes.
Mmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. I want to see, like, what part, like, does it go into the gill and then, like, it, like, the gills close?
No.
Or?
On the mycelium, which is the part that's underground, like, what we think of as mushrooms, this is a fruiting body. And then, so there's this whole network. And it looks very much like your neural network, and it works very much like your neural network. But there's this whole network, and the mycelium has these little, works a lot like sea anemone. Stingers, you know, just these little teeny tiny darts that go into the nematode when it brushes against the mycelium, and then it grows around it and absorbs it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
You know, that's all I've got.
Yeah, I know, it's really fascinating, also your knowledge, and also that you built it partly yourself, or partly it's coming back from home. And I think it's also special because a lot of people just complain that...
Well, I mean, coming back from home, I'm on a new continent now, so I've had to learn a whole... Like, I don't remember ever seeing this plant that I just pointed out in North America. I don't know the name. I only know a Dutch name for it. There's a lot here. There are a lot of plants here that I've had to learn. I don't know what they are because they're not familiar to me.
How do you actually learn it? From books, from internet, from people, from some other sources?
All of those things. Like that plant I learned from a person up at the IDM, the garden witch up at the IDM.
Erica.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Shout out to Erica. Erica's wonderful.
She is. I'm not sure how much Erica had to do with the toxin remediation, because, like, the ground at the Slipfeld is super toxic, like, all the water treatment stuff, plus apparently when they demolish houses and grind up all the rubble, they took it up there. So all the weird shit is on the ground there, so... like the things, there's plenty of things you could eat, but the ground is too toxic, so you really don't want to. So they've started using mushrooms to just break down the toxins, and, like, it's amazing, you know. Certain varieties that they're using you should not eat, but other varieties, go ahead. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really, really fantastic, I think. And yeah, it's, Erica did, like, I know she got paid like thousands of euros to get the soil tested at multiple locations.
Closer to nature, like more in tune with the natural rhythms, you know. Like, I would like to, I mean, I'm doing it now, going to sleep when it's dark and getting up in the sun. Like, this is just partly because of my job, you know, because I've been carrying mail, so it's kind of convenient. But You know, I don't know what the do I want to sleep 18 hours in winter? I'm not a cat. I don't think I want to do that. That's what it would end up happening here, you know, when it's only light for 8 hours a day. But I would like to be able to get closer to natural rhythms. And like last year with all the foraging that I did, like I also took notes every time I went out somewhere, what did I find? And so I've got like sort of a calendar, you know, like to know what to expect. Like I know, I mean, I see it all around me, you know, all these are blooming, all that is blooming, da, 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 da. But I also can go back through my book and be like, oh, okay, this time last year, like this year is happening slower than last year. You know, I mean, we can feel it anyway, but like I've also documented it. And I want to be able to live closer to the natural rhythms. And it's hard. It's really hard. My job is here. My life is here in a city, for lack of a better term. I mean, it's the biggest village in the Netherlands, but it's a city. It's city life. And I used to like city life a lot more than I do now. I grew up in more rural places, and I think the older I get, the more I appreciate that. You know, I definitely didn't when I was younger, and I wanted to go to the cities. And okay, fine, I'm in a city, I can do all the city things, but I'd also like to just be able to chill and make a little fire and listen to the birds sing all day. Birds sing all day long, but you don't realize that in a city. You only hear them in the morning and then again at night. They sing all day long, I realized when I was living up at the IAM last month. Birds sing all day long. You just gotta be able to slow down so you can hear them. And that's just what happened last year, right? When everything shut down, suddenly you could hear the birds, even in the city. You could hear the birds singing all day. Right?
Yeah.
It's not just me. I think we should all slow down more.
That's true. I was just thinking today, I think today's a strong wind and the planes are running pretty low. Yeah. And I'm just hearing this sound every 2 minutes. And especially it changed so much because now much more planes are running after the corona period. And I just feel it is getting so intense for me. And before I wouldn't even notice. But I guess this whole corona also made a change when I got used not to hear the planes anymore so often. And not with, definitely not with this intensity as today. I don't know if you notice it.
I have. I really laughed. I heard another plane, and I looked up and I saw three seagulls fighting with the wind right there. You know, the plane scooted by, but the first thing I saw was the seagulls making this noise, and I just thought it was hilarious. Plane noise, anyway.
Yeah, but I'm really interested in as to like what gender perhaps is like. Earth or nature or like different parts of nature, and if you think maybe like the Cherokee, how you think like the Cherokee people might have thought about this, like pre white people arriving, and what impact do you think white people had on like how we see like maybe the gender of nature or earth?
There's a story about how the moon got the marks that we see on it. And in that story, the moon is actually male. And the sun, according to Cherokee tradition, is a woman. So there's that. As far as what gender is the earth, I feel like the earth is just beyond that. I feel like gender is such a human construct. I think it just doesn't even apply.
Yeah.
Why?
I wasn't sure. I didn't want to cut you off if you wanted to say something more. But I really love that because I really agree with what you said earlier, that at least so much of the dominance of gender comes, I think, from the rise of patriarchy and the church. And maybe, of course, there is some, like we have children, there is the biological sex that you're born with, like there is that aspect that will always be an undertone, but to me what appears is that things got a lot more gendered with patriarchy and with the church, and therefore it's like, why would we, yeah, maybe we wouldn't have had to walk around thinking that the earth is caring, therefore it's a woman. Like, the earth is caring, and it's rough, and it's lots of...
This is another way of absolving ourselves of doing work. Like, all these nurturing things, like if you think about this, the qualities that are attributed to feminine, you know, nurturing, mothering, but like all these nice, gentle, what else? I mean, you know, all these things that are ascribed to women, like, this takes a lot of effort to do these things.
Yeah, emotional labor, energetic labor.
Yeah, and you know, men are okay, it's okay to be violent, it's okay to laugh, it's not okay to do much else, because all that other shit is too much work. Like, so, you know, I we need another hour.
Well, we can have another episode. We'll book you back in.
Like, for me, the whole, like, my transition has been, again, that's a whole other hour, but like it's an ongoing process, and like I have felt like it's really important to think about what is masculinity, what should masculinity be, not just what is it, but what should it be. You know, and like I've had a lot of people in the last few years lay a lot of their issues with masculinity on me, just because I'm being perceived as more masculine as I go through the world than a few years ago. And I'm not going to say toxic masculinity is not a thing; it certainly is. But like a lot of people are conflating masculinity with toxicity, and this is not okay. This is not okay for multiple reasons, you know, because again, it absolves men of having to do work, of having to be better people, of having to deal with their emotions, of having to talk about their emotions, of having to not be afraid of how they might be perceived, you know? If only women are expected to be nurturing and patient and kind, then men are never going to be.
I want to come back to your enjoyment of nature and like connection to and lying on the soil and the ground, and ask, what about sex in nature? And have you had much experience like cruising in the city, or any experience cruising in the city, or any thoughts about that?
Sex in nature, yes, first of all.
Woohoo!
First of all, yes. I have quite some years ago in San Francisco, there was a group of dykes that decided that they wanted to go cruise, and so Friday night we're going to go, all the dykes are going to go to Dolores Park and cruise, and like it didn't work because all the butch dykes, like in the dark, you can't, like, are you looking at a dude, are you looking at a dyke, what are you looking at, you know? and so like there was, because of all the weird patriarchal shit, women weren't able to go out in the park and just have random sex with strangers like men do. There were a few attempts there, but like this is how it always ended up, you know? Everybody was afraid to approach everybody because of the fucking way the world works. So, here, I mean, you know, I remember once I just went through Ballin Park at night, and I decided I'm just gonna go sit over here by this little pond for a while, and I was just sitting there by the pond. I think I was even standing, you know, I just parked my bike and just kind of stood there and was kind of thinking, and what am I going to do? Where am I going to go? Whatever I was thinking about. And then this dude just kind of cycled up next to me, and like on the one hand, yeah, okay, there's some confirmation or affirmation rather, you know, like, okay, dude sees me and wants to crew, but like, I don't know how to navigate this socially. And actually, I recently asked a friend of mine from New York, who gay boy, who comes to visit periodically, like, when you come back, will you teach me how to navigate a dark room? Because I don't know how to do this. I would like to learn how. Because why not? And I would love to go cruise out in the park, but again, I don't know how to navigate this, especially not being a cis dude. You know, if somebody ever reaches in my pants and doesn't get what they expect, then what's going to happen? That's a whole other layer that I don't want to deal with. So I really want to learn how to socially navigate it first so that I can kind of maybe handle it better.
Yeah, me too. That's a call out. Maybe time for one more question.
Well,
the question.
Actually, I feel like I already asked the questions, but I guess with the gender first, I think I'm just stuck on this topic.
What do you think? How do you see the gender of Earth?
Well, actually, I'm wondering because, you know, there are these two sculptures in Amsterdam of Earth, and they're both called Mama. Like, there is Mama Baranka and Mama Aisha.
Oh, you have to point out Mama Aisha to me.
Yeah, Mama Aisha is just next to my house, and my house is called Kleiburg. It's like Clay City in Weimar.
Okay.
That's the name of my building. And next to it is the sculpture of Mama Aisha. And so, I mean, their Earth is also called mothers in a lot of, like, traditional cultures, I guess. So I'm wondering about this, because for me also it feels like Earth could have been beyond the notion of gender. But it seems to be very connected to this motherhood, mother role, right?
In Cherokee culture, it's the Earth isn't gendered, actually. Now that I think about it, the Earth, like, it's Turtle Island because the Earth is created on the turtle's back. And there's no gender to it. Turtle dove down, and I'm actually not supposed to tell animal stories unless it's winter, so I'm not going to tell you what happened, but that's why it's called Turtle Island, and there's no gender attached to it.
All right, well, we've got a date for the next episode with Bear in the winter time. Animal stories with Bear in the winter.
I mean, then, yeah.
We can do an update on the cruising. That's the homework.
Maybe I can share with you my darkroom experiences next time.
Oh, what?
Wait. Next time! We've got another hour!
In winter! When does the winter start?
Well, definitely not yet.
No, 6 months away. 7 months, actually.
Alright, is it in?
The solstice will be around the 20th or 21st, so then after that, then we can...
Oh, right, so the winter starts on solstice, because in Russia it starts on 1st of December.
No.
But not here.
I like the tradition.
Anyway, it starts on solstice.
All right, so thank you both so much for today. I have really, really enjoyed, and yeah, thanks for sharing so many personal stories.
Both. Yeah, I actually also very much appreciated to hear, and I felt like I got to know you so much more in just these 2 hours.
Yeah, me too. All right.
Thank you for sharing the space and facilitating, Tanya.
My pleasure, you're welcome.
Thanks.